I recently got into slow scan TV, as we discussed, and I have a USB cable coming out of the computer going to the Big Blaster. I think this is more of a technical question than a computer question. I've got noise data coming out of the USB port. I know it's coming out of there and not the computer, because if I disconnect the cable, it totally goes away. If I wrap my hand around the cable, I act like an antenna and it increases. What do you think the best way to eliminate that is? Do you think I could use some donuts, you know, big fries, and wrap the cord around that? What do you think, Dick? Antilio.
Without a doubt, the donuts are a good thing to try. It's inexpensive, easy, and it can't hurt. But it's a little bit of a brute force approach. If you can find out what the original problem is, by that I mean data going over a cable, a Cat5-like cable, for instance, where each individual signal is a pair of wires, and if those parallel wires are being fed in a thoroughly differential manner, like twin leads, they cannot radiate. If they're really being fed in a differential manner, they cannot radiate. Now, what could cause that to start radiating when it previously, by design, didn't radiate? If something grounds one of those two leads back at the chassis where the signal is coming from, that would take a thoroughly balanced system, a differential system, and now make it into one grounded wire and one hot wire that's acting as an antenna. But twisted wires, even as high as 1,000 megahertz, are amazingly well shielded as long as the signal is absolutely equal on those two wires. Let me drop quick. If at each instant of time, if the right-hand wire goes plus 1 volt and the left-hand wire goes minus 1 volt, on the next half cycle, they reverse, but as long as they're thoroughly balanced, being used in a thoroughly differential manner, even though there is no shielding around the wire, it acts like it's amazingly well shielded. We're talking about 50, 60 dB of shielding here. So if you study the source and find out if anything went wrong, assuming it had a good design, a real good differential design for the sending end and a real good differential receiving end, then the system is extremely well shielded. So I'd recommend a dual approach. Go ahead and use the ferrite. But the ferrite is going to knock it down some number of dB, maybe 10 dB. If it was intended to be a differential design, and something knocked out that differential function, a failure of the chip or whatever, by way of an oscilloscope, you could confirm this using a A minus B function on two probes on a good oscilloscope, a dual channel oscilloscope. You can check this out as to whether or not it's being used. Let me drop this. Whether or not the original source of the signal is being used in a fully differential manner. And so you may find out that a chip failure or a mysterious grounding or whatever took place, assuming it was well designed to begin with. If it was not so well designed, and your particular piece of electronics is doing the sending, maybe it has developed a history. And if you go and Google that model number and find out if people have had radio frequency interference problems, you may discover that it's got a history, and maybe there are people who have already found a solution. On the internet, there's a lot of information along these lines. And yes, signing into the computer net might also help, because I think it's a somewhat computer function you're talking about here. N2EO, K2LAW, Rich, drag your feet in case other people have something to contribute to this one. N2EO with a delay, K2LAW in the tech net.
K2IZ.
Go right ahead, Joe. Sorry, John.
Yeah, it's, Dick, you're right about the ferrite, because, you know, we had to learn all about that stuff the hard way, running in wires, you know, for data circuits across fluorescent lamps. You know, first we had to use shielded wire, ground one side, but then as stimulus in there, it reduces, you know, a lot of the problems. It might be just an old cable where you might be running wires side by side. Also, I tried to get in a little sooner, but I couldn't. Just on that last subject about you said about capacitors, there's a place called Hayseed Hotel, the Yankee Sierra Echo Delta, HayseedHamFest.com, and they have shop ham radio capacitors, tubular and electrolytic capacitors, and they have recap kits for Collins, Drake, Hallicrafters, Hamlin, Heathkit Nationals, and miscellaneous stick. Sorry, I just want to bring that up to the guys that were looking for the capacitors. Over.
Okay. Run that by again. Hayseed, H-A-Y-S-E-E-D. And what is that? Hayseed.com. Give me the full email address again, John. Go ahead.
One word. Hayseed Hotel Alpha Yankee Sierra Echo Delta Hotel Alpha Mike Foxtrot Echo Sierra Tango. HayseedHamFest.com. And again, it's they listed as suppliers new can type and tubular electrolytic capacitors, and they have recap kits. I have an HW16 I want to start on, and they have a complete recapacitor kit for that radio. But again, they do Collins, Drake, Hallicrafters, Hamlin, Heathkit, National, and a few others. Over.
And if I understand correctly, HayseedHamFest.com. No punctuation between Hayseed and HamFest. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Roger.
Okay. That was antique radio, one way or another. Looks like all those rare parts are obtainable. I was very disappointed when I tried to buy an electrolytic capacitor at 450 volts, 1 microfarad, seemingly a very simple, or is it 600 volts, not sure which, at the Radio Shack, and you go to their website, and the part was sitting there with a part number. So I walked into the Radio Shack store with a Xerox copy of that website of theirs with that part number and said, please sell me one of those. To which he said, we don't stock that. You got to get that from the warehouse. That's when Radio Shack was still there a couple years ago. Looks like transistors, voltage type capacitors, they've got those, but tube type capacitors at high voltages, they're not being stocked in the majority of places like that anymore. So it's us guys that keep up antique radios. Let's see, I think Hal wanted to say something along these lines earlier. K6DPZ, any words you want to add to all of the above, Hal? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Rich and 2EO, back to you, sir.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, this is not a Cat 5. It's a special USB cable. It's not the run of the mill. It has a special plug on one end. It's like an RJ connector to go into the back of the Big Blaster. The other end is a USB cable to plug into the computer. So, it's not terrible, but there was noise here. As soon as I turn the computer on and it boots up, I hear it. It sounds like a buzz saw. So, it's data. Can't take.
When it comes to a USB to USB cable, I wonder if anyone knows about various brand names, various amounts of shielding, various qualities. USB to USB cable, are they all the same, or are there some basic differences in those cables? Does anybody know? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
Hey, you can hear me.
A little bit noisy, but we can hear you, and I'll repeat all of your words, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW, go right ahead.
Right now, I'll be climbing up the hill in a minute. USB is actually a serial cable. It's similar to 485, which is kinds of USB connectors. There's a different now called USB 3 and micro USB, USB 3 is from Charlie. The technology went to the fastest stuff.
So there's lots of kinds of USB cables is what you seem to be saying, Eric. Now, his particular kind of USB connector on each end, he probably doesn't have the ability to change that. But within that restriction, is it possible that his particular size of USB connector, that he could buy brand A, brand C of cable, where he might get different amounts of shielding and quality, so to speak? KE2EJ, K2IW, is that worth seeking?
There's different companies like Belfend and Linksys that make, essentially there's double shielded USB cable. They have a nice twist and they've got two shields, but it's only as effective as the device that you're connecting to. A lot of RF is actually coming out of the devices themselves as opposed to the cable.
If he buys a Cadillac brand of USB cable, which is known to be double shielded, and assume the shield is grounded at the chassis at his computer and at the chassis of his auxiliary piece of equipment, I think there's a chance he gets some improvement on radiated radio frequency interference. Am I naive on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I stand a chance against the double shielded cable, but I don't know what he's using it for. So, you know, they make these sound card adapters and stuff like that. And, they put them in these little plastic cases and they lightly spray some conductive paint on the inside and it's basically worthless. So, you know. The other thing is, if the things are properly grounded at both ends, you stand a better chance, but a lot of cases, they don't even ground the shell at the receptacle of what you're plugging it into, so, you know, it depends what you're doing.
Do you know of any computer savvy, broadcast savvy, engineer type who took a USB cable where the connector was not grounded to the double shield in the cable itself at each end, but the connector was grounded? Itself inside of the computer able to make any improvement on radio frequency interference. Have you heard of anybody savvy enough to make those changes and make an improvement? Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
K2IW, K2EJ. Actually, a lot of the industrial grade computers don't radiate anything and they make good, solid connecting tubes. Cables that go external. A lot of computers, just turn the computer on and you've got a noise generator. So add a cable to it and now you've added a longer antenna to the noise generator. There are good systems that are designed to be in RF environment. And there's the consumer stuff where they don't care too much. As long as it falls within the Part 15 guidelines, they don't care.
It is my guess, Rich, that you've got a receiver, a radio receiver, that is being interfered with. If you made yourself a small test cable, a BNC cable, where you put a small loop on the end where the center conductor goes over to the shield, and you use that as a sniffer, and you hold it near various portions of your USB cable and the computer and whatever, you'll be able to confirm by watching the signal strength meter as you move your sniffer around where the signal is coming from, and as you make these changes of coiling the cable, putting up a ferrite bead, changing brand name of cable, and maybe somebody sells a cable which is known to be double shielded and well grounded on each end, there's various ways that you can quantitatively see the amount of radio frequency interference and exactly where it's coming from if you want to do that research, Rich. N2EO, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yes, that was a good idea. It's easy enough to do. Thing is, I'm kind of locked into this USB cable because it's standard USB on one side. The other side goes to the replacer, which is RJ45. I have no idea how they got that wired on that side.
Let's see if Eric knows. Is an RJ45, is there any built-in grounding there? I'm a little bit worried that it's not. So that even if he bought a good USB to USB cable, and then he bought some kind of an adapter that went from RJ45 to USB, he might not get a ground carry through, if you know what I mean. Any words of wisdom on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Eric got to the place where he's doing his business. Go ahead, John.
You pin break out. I mean, you pin break out on RJ45 when they're using 10 gig. It's 1236. Pairs 4 and 5 were used for dial tone. 7 and 8 were spare, but now they've gone to 100 gig. And I think they use all 8 pairs in there, no grounding in there. I've made a plethora of those cables by hand, and it's just stick. There's no ground in there. The reduction in noise is supposed to be taken care of by the tight twist of the Cat 5. Again, you look at a pin breakout for RJ45 in the old 10 gig system. Pairs 1, 2, 3, and 6, which became white, green. Was 3, green, white was 6, 4 and 5 were blue and white that we used for, if you're using a phone line, for a phone line, and then 7 and 8 with white, brown, white. So again, there's no ground in there, Dick. It's just, you know, it's just a cable.
If the signals coming down that cable are being used in a fully differential manner, and if the cable is shielded, and grounded at one end, at the computer end, that combination, I think, would give you a lot of total shielding. So, differential signal, shielded cable, and the shielded cable grounded at least one end, at the sending end. I think that would help an awful lot. What do you think on that one, John? K2IZ, K2RIW?
On RJ45, Cat 5, Cat 6, whatever you want to call it nowadays, there's no ground. When you wire these things up, and again, I wired up a lot of major call centers, spent a lot of time punching down, there's nothing on the block for grounding. All you have to do is just adhere to the standards of, 10 gig was under 300 feet. That was the length that you can go on that. After that, the signal started degrading. So all of our stuff were like under 300 feet. But again, Dick, I can see those patch panels in my sleep, blue, orange, green, brown. There's no grounding facilities on there. I've never heard of, I haven't heard, which doesn't mean it's ain't out there. I've never heard of grounded cable grounding on one end. Again, the only time we ever did that was in the days of pre-Cat 3, Cat 5, where we had circuits with the wire running across fluorescent lights. And we would use a shielded cable, also use a shielded cable on a T1 circuit, grounded at one end, because the pairs didn't have that tight of a twist. Dick, over.
Yeah, if you've got RJ45 on both ends, something like Cat 5, Cat 6 in between, I agree with what you're saying. He's got a USB connector on one end of his cable. There is the ability to take that grounded end USB connector into a double shielded USB cable, which then goes into this conversion in his system over to RJ45 on the receiving end, in which case only that tiny little bit of RJ45 wiring will be the potential radiator, and the rest of the system could be shielded because it's basically USB. He's not RJ45 on both ends. It's USB on the, at least on the sending end, John. K2IZ, K2LIW.
2MOD.
Parents home, and then, well, I had a rig blast here, and again, the only thing I did was, you know, it's stuff that you taught us over the years. Trust me, Dick, I've listened to a lot of your talks over the years. Stuff that you tell us, you can't just have wires hanging down loose all over the place. If I have any excess at all, I just coil it up in a coil, and kind of like a, what you call it? One I used to have up on the tri-bander was the, the RF choke up there. Like I say, I've listened to a lot of your talks, and that's one thing you've always emphasized is, you know, leave slack like this. No, coil it up and eliminate your problems. Dick, I'll turn it back to you. There's someone else in there, over.
Yeah, I think I heard N2MOD, Paul. Go ahead, N2MOD, K2LIW.
Good evening, everybody. If you could just let me know the exact model number of his rig blaster, that would help out. Because I'm looking on the website right now, and I don't see any of the current models that use a good connector for the USB rig blaster's end. They all seem to be A to B type, printer type USB connectors. So if you could let me know the exact model number, I'll do a little bit more research on that.
Very fine, Paul. Paul, when you come back to us, you must speak more softly. You're overmodulating and jumping out, and therefore getting blanked. But we got your message. So what's the model number of your rig blaster that you're using, Rich? And maybe even the model number of the computer that has the USB connector at one end. N2EO, K2RAW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, the Rig Blaster is a current model, just bought it. It's called a Rig Blaster Advantage. Rig Blaster Advantage. And the computer is a Hewlett Packard HP 50. Laptop.
Okay, so the HP 15 sounds like it's the source of the noise, and the Rig Blaster Advantage is trying to receive those signals over that USB cable, which gets converted to an RJ45. And let's see if Paul has some further information on all of the above. N2MOD, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
Hey, firstly, I'm sorry about the overmodulation. It's been years since I've used this rig. Okay, let me just go and do a little bit more research on this. Now that I know the exact model number, I can be more specific in my search. And with that, I'll bid everybody a good evening. And to MOD, clear.
And Paul, very glad you signed in with that help. You sound good now that you're speaking a little more softly. Go ahead and do your research. And as we proceed with the rest of the TechNet, which goes on for a couple more hours, break in whenever you've got that information. Rich tends to listen all night long. And even if he doesn't, these TechNets all get recorded by going to amateurradio.tangovictor. You can see 10.5 years of TechNet all recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back 4 hours worth of TechNet into whatever system you want to play it into. So even if Rich falls asleep, you can give us the information and it'll get recorded, if you know what I mean. So that beautiful service comes from Mike number one, KC2NJI, who for over 10 years has been recording TechNet as well as other nets, the other technical net in New Jersey. He records that one too. And when it comes to supporting information for the TechNet you're now listening to, let me drop it. Mike number one I just mentioned is KC2NJI. Mike number two is K1MJM. And he has a website that's at limarktechnet.com, which has supporting information, pictures and diagrams and charts, graphs, and articles. So you can find a look like by going to that picture. Sort of. You see a selfie of me on the tower. You see a couple of pictures of me in various antennas. Alrighty. Let's see if Joe has thought of anything he... We've got an opening for Joe if he wants to use it. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. One of the guys who frequently signs in. We give him a tough time sometimes, but we're going to apologize for that. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, if you want to use your time right now with any question or comment. K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
You mean the guy who infrequently signs in? Okay. Yeah, okay. I got a question for you. Alright. And here goes. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. If you were going to design a filter, very simplistic filter, to try to reduce or eliminate as much as possible noise being emitted out of an LED type of light, would you want to go for something like 10,000 to 1 ratio, 1,000 to 1 ratio, 100,000 to 1 ratio? In other words, what I'm asking at, if you have a target frequency, I'm saying in my case, I happen to find this thing putting out noise impulses or extraneous noise at 200 megahertz. And if I use a LC type of filter, where the C going to ground, looking out of the hot side of the socket that feeds power to this LED light, would be very low reactant, something on the order of like 10 ohms. And if I put an L in series that had a very, very high reactance to the, something like maybe a megohm at that frequency, do you think something like that would be advantageous to use, or should you use a different combination of components to arrive at the, you know, the result of trying to get the noise knocked down as much as possible? Back to you.
Most of the electromagnetic interference filters that I know of that must feed power through are usually set up with a pi configuration as far as the schematic is concerned. C1 to ground, series inductor, C2 to ground. And the power flows through from C1, hot lead, through the inductor to C2, hot lead. And so that's how the power flows through. Now, once you've selected the pi filter network, there's a zillion ways you can do it. It is my belief, if you go to the right reference, web article, whatever, you can find out what happens, what is the amount of decibels of shielding you get at various frequencies. You get a particular curve of decibels of shielding versus frequency. If you use 1 microfarad capacitors and 10 millihenry conductors, for instance, which maybe that's approximately the number that was used on the 120-volt AC circuits. That was the raw power at 400 hertz going into each one of the line replaceable units on the B-1B bomber program that I worked on for 20 years. I said 120 volts, it's actually 240. 240 volts, 400 hertz, went through this kind of a pi filter on each individual line replaceable unit. And of course they wanted to, let me drop. They would like to have the filtering be, let me pick a number, 80 dB DC to light. Of course they're not going to get that. So as you choose those capacitors, as you choose that inductor, your low-pass filter function has a particular operating curve. Throughout most of that region, the energy fed through is falling off 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. And so where's that lower cutoff? How steep is that curve? Which one of those curves you want to use? There's no ideal capacitor-inductor combination. It's a trade-off. But that pi network is the most frequently used filter assembly for electromagnetic filtering, with a well-shielded case with good grounding everywhere, low inductance on all of that wiring, and that so-called filter that I'm describing was in a separate container as you entered the line replaceable unit. It was called the dirty box. So the power went into that network, into that particular box, went through that filter, and then it finally got into the innards of that line replaceable unit, another great big shielded box, which typically was 60 pounds, handles on the sides. Let me think now. It looked to me like it was about 16 inches wide, 8 inches high, 20 some odd inches deep. The rough numbers I'm giving you for each one of these boxes, and they all had that kind of a filter. So there is no ideal number, Phil, as I see it, Joe. Let me drop it. When you do find the right reference, you're going to be able to choose which curve do you think will be good enough for you. If you had the resources, you'd like the input capacitor to be a zillion microfarads. Well, if you try to feed 60-cycle signal through there, of course, it's going to give you a lot of reactive current that your local power company...
Repeater, time out.
That your local power company is not going to be not going to be happy with. So there is no ideal. You pay your money, you take your choice. 10 microfarads AC electrolytic capacitor might be beautiful, but it's going to give you a lot of current drain. It's a large object, and it takes up volume in dollars. So you're probably going to end up using disc ceramic capacitors. And also, to filter your particular light-emitting diode power supply noise is one approach. Shielding, filtering, putting ferrite transformers around that wire, all of these things will help. Choosing the right brand name of a light-emitting diode power supply is another big variable in this particular case. I know I haven't given you much of an answer. I've given you a little bit of a description of what are the variables involved, and as I said, there's no ideal solution, but I guarantee there's a website somewhere that will show you a bunch of those curves for what happens with 0.1 microfarad capacitors, 1 microfarad capacitors, 20 millihenry coils, 100 millihenry coils, and so on. There's going to be a website that's going to show you those transfer curves, I believe, to B2LYY. K2LIW. Drag your feet in case somebody knows of a website that gives us that info. You got it, Joe. K2LIW.
Well, Dick, the whole idea, the idea is, the basic idea is to try to filter the noise. That's number one. But number two, in this particular fixture, this is the bottom of a fan assembly, okay? You know, the top part is a rotating fan, and the bottom part is where the light goes into it, three sets of sockets. I don't have a lot of room to put large components up in that assembly. That's why I thought of using something like, I worked out some calculations on a calculator, and I come out with, I happen to have like 82 PF caps. Well, the reactors are 82 PF at 200 megas, around 9 ohms and change. So I figure, well, if I go 100,000 ohms, 100,000 times that with a reactor, I'm going to come up with a value of something like 790 microhenry for chokes. And that would give me a way of, you know, shunting most of that energy to ground, because I don't have a lot of room inside these lights to be able to play with something and put huge capacitors and huge inductors, and I can't put the stuff within the wall to do it either. I don't have the room to do that. Back to you.
Yeah, calculating the number of ohms of capacitor reactants at your desired frequency versus the size of the capacitor. That's the beginning of a calculation. A pi network filter is a combination of how many ohms of capacitor reactants to ground on each end, how many ohms of inductor reactants in between, and a relatively complicated relationship in between. Do you have to make the number of ohms of capacitor reactants at your desired filtered frequency be 9 ohms? I'm not sure, because the reactance of the capacitor, that's just one of three variables involved. The combination of the two capacitors and the inductor work together with synergism. Synergy is the word I'm looking for, I think. In other words, you get more benefit than the individual components would lead you to believe. Let me drop. Therefore, to find a website that will give you those curves for this particular pi network design with these particular values, that's one way. Another way is you could find yourself MATLAB or some other modeling program where you plug in the values of the capacitors and it plots for you the curve. That's another approach. I think Eric brought to our attention that there is a commercial product you can buy, which is relatively compact, sold in electrical supply stores, where you can take this relatively small object that's not very expensive and put it in series with the line. And it's a pi filter network that for many people is enough, and it gives them a solution. So buying something that already exists, finding a program, finding a website, let me drop it. That'll tell you what performance you're going to get for each individual set of values, or modeling it yourself. So, as I said, just calculating the reactance of the capacitor and the inductor at the beginning of the process, but they work together. The inductor has got a lagging phase, the capacitors have leading phase, the pi network together acts a bit differently. You may think that with 9 ohms of capacitor reactance, you're getting 15 dB of shielding, but that whole pi network of 9 ohms of capacitor reactance and 20 ohms of inductor reactance and another 9 ohms of capacitor reactance, that whole combination may give you 40 dB of shielding. It may be more than enough. So there's a little bit more to it involved than just that just that one calculation, as I see it there, Joe. I know you haven't gotten an answer you can go out whistling that tune, but if you find that website, and if I get a chance, I'm going to go look for one of those, which I think there's a website somewhere that's going to tell you how many dB of filtering you get at each individual frequency. It'll give you a curve. W-E-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet. Okay, Eric, I think you've brought to our attention a commercial product, Pi Network Filter, that's easy to add to a 110-volt line. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
What was the question? I didn't hear it. Sorry.
Hey, you got a little bit of squealing in the background that you probably know about. In the past, you brought to our attention a kind of line filter that works on a 110-volt, 60-cycle line, for instance, which I think is a miniaturized pi network capacitor, inductor capacitor, a commercial product that's used for EMI filtering. His problem, he's got a light-emitting diode power supply built into a rotary fan at the ceiling where there's not much room in there. He's getting a fair amount of radio noise out of that light-emitting diode power supply, and he'd like to make some improvement. So I think there was a Pi Network commercial product that you brought to our attention a week or two ago, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Give me a second. Yeah, what I was talking about is a commercial line filter. In practically every device these days, that's rack mounted or... Anyway, there's EMI line filters, and they're basically two chokes and two capacitors and some other stuff. You put the 110 line through or the 120 line through, and they come with a switch, on and off switch, and socket for three-prong, power cord. They come as a little block that you can put in wherever you want. You have to hook it up to your chassis ground. It takes neutral and hot and ground, and the ground is an important part too. And you can get them from DigiKey. You can get them from pretty much any of the big electronic supply places.
So, the one that is a three-prong socket type thing, he could put that at the end of the power cord, but that might be too little too late, where the hold-on power cord going up to his ceiling fan is an antenna. And maybe there isn't a power cord, maybe it's all wired behind the wall of his house. So, maybe what he's looking for is an EMI filter that is a small assembly that he can put somewhere in the wiring close to the fan. Roughly how voluminous is this thing? I mean, depending on the volume of the thing, he's going to hardwire it into his power cable. How big how many dollars, if you happen to know, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Sorry, K2RIW, K2EJ. They make them small. I think I looked after we had that discussion, I think I saw one that was like 3 inches by 5 inches or 3 inches by 3 inches, and they just have terminals on both ends. It's a little metal box that you can put anywhere. They come various different sizes and styles, you know, and they run from like $3 to $10, depending upon what you're buying, whether it has a switch, whether it has a socket. The ones without the sockets are cheaper. You've got to look and see what you want. But I mean, if the guy's got a little LED supply and it's making all that racket, just get rid of it.
Can I say something here? Because you're just going the wrong way with this thing.
Okay. Is there an easy way of replacing that LED light itself that's making the noise? Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Yes, I suppose I could change the LED bulbs themselves. I happen to like them because they give me the desired brilliance that I'm looking to get. I tried with a lower wattage, rating wattage, for the same manufacturer, and it doesn't seem to put out as much noise, but that may be a function of how much current the thing draws. But keep this in mind. I want to put this in the inside bottom of a ceiling fan. It's in a ceiling. There's no lamp cord running up the wall to this device in the ceiling. I have wiring in the house that was put up there many, many years ago, and I really can't get it in very easily. I could, but I'd rather just put it in the bottom, this assembly, or something simple with simple components, in the bottom of the ceiling fan. And I have at least two of them I want to try it on. One has a socket for one lamp, but the one I use the most in the kitchen happens to have a socket for three lamps in it. So, yeah, I could go back and forth crazily and try different manufacturers' bulbs, and I might come home and find they do the same thing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, you can't put a 3x5 thing in there. I understand that. Is there a way that you can take apart the ceiling fan enough, take it away from the ceiling, so that the power cord going into it is exposed to you, and you can interrupt that cord and put a filtering device in series with that cord? Is that out of the question, Joe? To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm going to transmit anyway. Yeah, I can take the bottom end of it apart. Remember, it has two switches inside in the bottom end before the, going towards the, between the fan blades and the light assembly itself. It has two switches, full chain switches. So they take up some room. It's got some other small, looks like possibly a small filter or something else in there also. So there's not a lot of room in this socket assembly above the sockets. Where the wiring goes. There's not a lot of room in there. I really, can't play with the large components. That's why I thought of using something small, a choke, and a cap to ground. If you tell me it won't work, then I just have to live with the interference, I guess.
Okay, too, Jack.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm just doing a little testing here. I'm trying to see, because I've got 375 listening, but there seems to be an issue with the transmitter, so I just wanted to make sure that it's not the receiver at Glen Oaks, which it's not.
Yeah, I did some listening on 375 during your last transmission. Oh, I'm hearing myself on 375, but I wasn't hearing you on 375. Does that mean that we're somewhat back in operation, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, somewhat. The transmitter's been getting some noise that going back towards Glen Oaks. I just got to figure out what it is. Because you probably heard some noise before in between your pre-ups, and that was just transmitting. Although I'm transmitting on the length frequency from the car right now. I just wanted to make sure that there's no problem at Glen Oaks, which obviously there isn't.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting that I hear my voice coming out of 375, a little bit of noise. But I don't hear yours, and I guess it's something to do with the way you're going into the machine. So have you made most of the repairs you're going to make tonight, or are you fixing to do something else? Over to you, Eric.
Well, I got to make it so that you can hear the people that are transmitting out out there. If you wait a second, I'll transmit on 375, and let's see if you hear it on 85.
Okay, I'm standing by for your test. You tell me what to listen to and when. Right now, I'm hearing my voice coming out of 375 beautifully, but I don't hear yours. Over to you, Eric.
There we go. Okay. All right, now let me see. Oh, now it sounds clear. All right, I'm transmitting on 375 now.
I'm hearing you beautifully on a 375 and 85 simultaneously. You're coming out of both, and you sound good, except for a little bit of squealing. I'm not worried about that. You sound good, Eric. Go ahead. Now I'm hearing you out of 375, but you're not coming out of 85, Eric. Go ahead.
Hello. Alright, now I gotta discover what this issue is. But sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yep. Your last transmission, you came out of 85, didn't come out of 375. Briefly, you came out of 375, but not 85. I'm hearing my voice coming out of both. So, with my way of going in to Glen Oaks, I come out of both. Your way of doing whatever you're doing, it's a little random as to where you come out, Eric. Go ahead. I heard you say hello, and you're coming out of 375, not coming out of 85, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the problem I'm trying to deal with right now.
I heard you out of 85, but not out of 375.
Yeah, the reason why you don't hear me out of 375 right now is because I'm transmitting directly to Glen Oaks rather than going through the repeater.
Roger, Dodger. I'll stand by, ready for your next experiment.
Are you hearing yourself on 85 every time you talk?
I'm always coming out of 85, and for the last few minutes, I'm coming out of 375 beautifully. You don't, but I do. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, no, that's not what I meant. What I meant, you need to transmit on 375, but yeah, it can be confusing. You'll always hear yourself coming out of 375, but you're transmitting 285, you're not transmitting in 375.
Yeah, I'm always transmitting into 2585, and right now you're coming out of 85, but your voice is not coming out of 375.
That's because I'm not transmitting 375. I'm on a...
Roger, Dodger. We'll stand by.
Now, why don't you carry on? I'm going to go look at something inside. I'll be back. K2RIWK, 2J.
Okay, we'll carry on. I can see how you've definitely got a volume problem, an accessibility problem. There is a box, I'm guessing, a ceiling-mounted utility box behind the fan where you can disconnect the fan from the ceiling, and you're looking at the inside of that box, and somewhere going into that box is a power cable, and probably very difficult to get to that cable without crawling through the ceiling of your house. But if there's not enough volume in the box to put in the right kind of a filter, then with difficulty you could put a series filter of a larger size, so to speak, in series with that power cable going into the box. A tough way to go. Sounds like you've already done experiments with the size of the LEDs, maybe the brand name of the LEDs in the power supply. Let me drop. In previous weeks, we found out that there's a very competitive business out there building these constant current power supplies for light emitting diodes. They're switching-like power supplies. Because it's such a competitive business, very few of the companies are willing to invest in a quality, low interference type power supply. The majority of them have various amounts of noise that we've been hearing horror stories about. Not an easy problem. It's not going to be an easy solution. You're going to have to do a number of experiments, investigations, and whatever, Joe. And you're probably never going to get 80 dB more shielding. You have to decide how much you're willing to settle for, I think. I hope I'm not wrong. I hope I'm not right on this one. W2LYY, K2LIW. Hang in there, Joe. I know you can make improvement. I know it's not easy. You got it, Joe.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. Is it a ratio of 100,000 to 1, 50 decibels, as far as voltages, as far as voltage is concerned?
Power is a function of E squared over R. So, if you had a ratio of 100 volts, for instance, 100 squared is 10,000, 10,000 is 40 dB. So, when you're converting voltage into decibels of signal strength, it's 20 log of the ratio, if you know what I mean, because power is voltage squared. If you had 100,000 to 1 voltage ratio, 10 to the 5, that would be 10 to the 10, that would be 100 dB. 10 to the 5 voltage ratio is 100 dB, which is a big ratio in power. So voltage squared is what counts. Over to you, Joe. And by the way, if you multiply by 20 log, you're doing the same thing as squaring the voltage. If you use 10 log, no, so I took 10 log of voltage squared, it gives me the exact same number as 20 log of the voltage. I wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. To V2LYY, K2LIW.
I guess what I'm trying to get here is just a simple opinion, but I guess you don't want to step in that direction and give me an opinion. You think this a simple idea of the components I want to use will work, but I know I could fit, you know, a choke and a cap on the high side. I don't know if it's coming out of the ground side or not and being radiated on those wiring and that wiring. I don't know. That'd be kind of tough to kind of prove. I would think more of it's probably on the hot side of this lamp assembly. And I can't get it to stuff in the ceiling. I have to drop the whole ceiling fan mechanically to be able to do that. I can take the bottom end off where the lights actually go and leave the rest intact. I really don't I'm not trying to make this into a complete project, you know. I'm going to go crazy. But I know I have enough room in the bottom end of this thing to be able to put some small components. And I thought...
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
See? I have a fairly good voltage divider assembly going to ground. But you don't seem to agree with that.
I didn't say I don't agree, Joe. There's no exact solution. You would like a nice, simple answer. Use a 0.01 microfarad and a 20 millihenry choke, and the problem's going away. You'd like that to be the answer. Unfortunately, this is not that simple. You're going down a road that a number of people have gone down, and it's going to take experimenting. Your pi filter network is the magic thing if you have reasonable local grounding. And what does that mean in this particular case? If everything in that motor and everything in that light-emitting diode power supply is floating. Let me drop. At the other end where the light switch is by way of some sniffing, you may be able to find out, is the majority of the radiation conducted or radiated? Is the electromagnetic interference conducted or radiated? If the wiring from the fan down to the light switch that you have access to, if that wiring is doing the radiating, you're in a heap of trouble. It's not easy. Therefore, putting a filter down at the light, the on-off switch, is not going to do it. If it's conducted, if in other words, the wiring from the fan down to the switch is not doing most of the radiating, but the wiring through the rest of the house is doing it. By way of sniffing, you may be able to pin that down. It sure would be nice if you could put some kind of a filter at the switch that sends the power up to your fan. Because taking the fan apart in its compact box is going to be tough. I see that. And so, what size components is a function of how many dB of filtering you want. How many dB of filtering? There's got to be a website. You're going to be putting in a pi filter, I believe. How big must the components be in the pi filter? That's going to be a set of curves where you look at that curve, say that, okay, I'm getting a... Let me drop. I'm getting a lot of interference at 30 megacycles. So how many dB of filtering am I getting at 30 megacycles? So the filtering at higher frequencies is going to be better if that Pi network filter sees what it thinks is a proper ground. Well, everything here is floating, and so it's going to take some experimenting and sniffing and whatever. There's no simple solution on this one, Joe. I wish we had a glamour fix. I don't blame you for being frustrated on this one. You haven't gotten an answer. We've just given you more ingredients of the problem. W2LYY-K2LIW. Hang in there, Joe. It's possible to fix it. Unfortunately, it's not going to be as easy as you'd like. What else is new?
Well, I just thought bringing this up on the tech, that might be interesting, because maybe I might not be the only person out there that has this kind of interference problem. And hams usually like to try to fix things themselves, you know, within reason, instead of spending money buying filters and trying to put them in places that you can't get them. I just sort of bring up the idea maybe I'd get some creative input or so forth, but I don't know if I could fit enough parts to make a Pi network filter on both power legs. I don't know if that's really going to be going to be possible with the room up there. I don't have a lot of room inside the thing, so I guess I'm just going to have to try it myself, and maybe I'll come back with the answer if I happen to come up with an answer that tells me that it took care of most of the problem. This primarily come up with why I brought the subject up, because it was basically bothering channel RF channel 13. That's where this whole thing started from. When I took a better look at it, I noticed there's some noise in the lower part of the VHF going down to like about 150, 140, 130 meg, but I don't really see it in the lower VHF, like 30 to 50 meg, so it seems to be like it's radiating much, much higher in a higher frequency band than a lower frequency band. That's why I thought of trying to filter out primarily where it's annoying me.
My first recommendation, Joe, from everything we've heard tonight, tells me if you go to the DigiKey catalog and look at all of the products they've got that do line filtering, you may find some of them have a reasonable price, reasonable size, inline type circuit where you wire, you have twisted wire nuts on the input end and on the output end, and you just put this in series with the wire as close as you can get to the fan. There may be a product in DigiKey that comes close. Rather than actually build the filter network yourself, choosing an inductor, choosing a capacitor, let me drop. The DigiKey vendors have been down this road before you and I have. And so they've got filter networks. For all we know, the DigiKey catalog has got 30 products that come close to addressing this problem. And maybe some of them are only $3, $4, and $5, if you know what I mean. So I would check the DigiKey catalog rather than homebrewing all the way. This is such a prevalent problem so many people have got the last few years. I'd like to believe DigiKey has got a product in their catalog that's going to help. It's a matter of you choosing the one that's the right size and the right number of dollars. W2LYY-K2LIW. Give that a try, Joe.
Okay, I see this is getting rung out pretty good, so you can pass it over to the next guy with in line here. W-H-1-Y-Y, I'll be listening.
And as you do further research and experiments, Joe, come back and tell us, even if you don't have a success, come back and tell us, I tried this, it didn't work, I tried that, it didn't work. You're allowed to use our crying cow, if you know what I mean. I mean, the pack rats... After each major VHF-UHF contest, the pack rats, the Mount Airy VHF Society, those guys get together, what they call a crying tower session, where they describe to each other all the things that Murphy's Law did to them during that particular contest weekend. So you'll get some good listeners here that'll listen to your grief as you go through it. So come back and tell us, even if it didn't work. We've gone down the list of everybody who signed in that had a question.